come to consideration of other techniques, of non-terroristic techniques for inducing consent and for inducing people to love their servitude. I don't think I can possibly go into all of them because I don't know all of them, but I mean I can mention a few of the more obvious methods which can now be used and which are based upon recent scientific findings. First of all, there are the methods connected with straight suggestion and hypnosis. I think we know much more about this subject than was known in the past. People, of course, have always known about suggestion, and although they didn't know the word hypnosis, they certainly practiced it in various ways. But we have, I think, a much greater knowledge of the subject than in the past, and we can make use of our knowledge in ways which I think the past was probably never able to make use of it. For example, one of the things we now know for certain is that there is, of course, an enormous, I mean, this has been always known, a very great difference between individuals in regard to their suggestibility. But we now, I think, know pretty clearly the sort of statistical structure of a population in regard to its suggestibility. It's very interesting when you look at the findings in different fields. I mean, in the field of hypnosis, in the field of administering placebos, for example, in the field of general suggestion in states of drowsiness or of light sleep, you will find the same sorts of orders of magnitude continually cropping up. You will find, for example, that the experienced hypnotists will tell one that the percentage of people who can be hypnotized with the utmost facility, just like that, is about 20%. That about a corresponding number at the other end of the scale are very, very difficult or almost impossible to hypnotize. And that in between there lies a large mass of people who can, with more or less difficulty, be hypnotized. They can gradually be, if you work hard enough at it, be got into the hypnotic state. And in the same way, the same sort of figures crop up again, for example, in relation to the administration of placebos. A big experiment was carried out 3 or 4 years ago in the General Hospital in Boston on post-operative cases where several hundred men and women suffering comparable kinds of pain after serious operations were given injections whenever they asked for them, whenever the pain got bad, and the injections 50% of the time were of morphia and 50% of the time were of distilled water, and about 20% of those who went through the experiment, about 20% of them got just as much relief from the distilled water as from the morphia. About 20% got no relief from the distilled water, and in between were those who got some relief or got relief occasionally. So here again we see the same sort of distribution. Well, as I say, on the basis of this, I think we see quite clearly that human populations can be categorized according to their suggestibility fairly clearly. I suspect very strongly that this 20% is the same in all these cases. And I suspect also that it would not be at all difficult to recognize in very early childhood who were those who were extremely suggestible, who were those who were extremely unsuggestible, and who were those who occupy the intermediate space. Quite clearly, if everybody were extremely unsuggestible, organized society would be quite impossible. And if everybody were extremely suggestible, then dictatorship would be absolutely inevitable. I mean, it's very fortunate we have people who are moderately suggestible in the majority and who therefore preserve us from dictatorship, but do permit organized society to be formed. But once given the fact that there are these 20% of highly suggestible people, it becomes quite clear that this is a matter of enormous political importance. For example, any demagogue who is able to get hold of a large number of these 20% of suggestible people and to organize them is really in a position to overthrow any government in any country.
The first time that I read Cormac McCarthy's novel Blood Meridian, there was an introduction written by the critic Harold Bloom. This may have been an excerpt from his book How to Read and Why, but he talked about how it took him something like four times of attempting to read the novel before he was finally able to do it, and he kept getting put off by the violence, which is incessant in that book, as anyone who's read it knows. The violence and depravity and moral emptiness, metaphysical emptiness even. And you know, at the time, basically I thought, wow, what a pussy. I mean, I was in my early 20s, so I would say my stage of peak edgelording probably would have been mid-teens to mid-20s. I wasn't super obnoxious or anything, although I was probably a little bit obnoxious. It's just that I sought out transgressive literature and art of all kinds. And I regard this period as necessary for my intellectual and maybe even moral development. But it was just as necessary to grow out of it. What happened to me recently was that I was trying to reread Blood Meridian. And one night, I was staying up with my newborn son. He was probably between 1 and 2 months old at the time. And I picked up the book for something to occupy my mind. And I happened to get to that notorious scene with the tree hung with dead babies, which I most certainly recalled that it was there, but this time when I got to it, I had to put the book down. I thought, I can't read this. Not now. This image doesn't register with me in the same way that it did when that image was just an aesthetic object for contemplation. Which brings me to the book at hand, which is a book that I experienced multiple failures trying to read recently, till I finally just finished. The work, of course, being Programmed to Kill by David McGowan. Of course, Blood Meridian is a work of fiction. There's always going to be, and maybe it's just a simple matter of framing, but there's always going to be a way in which we just process things differently when something is fiction. Now, it is largely based on historical events, and although the book is extreme, none of what he describes really goes beyond the plausible, and certainly not the possible. Not when you know the kinds of things that have occurred and even do regularly occur in history, even to this moment. The question the current book under discussion raises, I think, is how much do you want to know? I mean, the edgelord in me, of course, is completely against such things as trigger warnings and safe spaces. But I would, without hesitation, issue trigger warnings for Program to Kill to anyone that I might recommend it to. And I would also add that I do not recommend this book to most people. This is a red-pilling book, possibly a black-pilling book. Now, you know the difference between the red pill and the black pill, right? I assume we all understand these meme concepts, but to remind you anyway, red pill shows you the truth, that you are a slave, Neo. Now, the black pill, not included in the original film, of course, shows you the same truth with the proviso that there's nothing to be done. You can fight, but you cannot win. The way the scenario normally plays out with red pill versus blue pill, we think you take the blue pill, which is the forget you even asked pill, the watch TV and go to sleep pill. We think that's the coward's way. But up against the black pill, the blue pill seems not only rational, but reasonable. I suppose what goes without saying in this scenario is that you, when you take your pill, you're going to believe what you see and accept the new paradigm. But that's not always really a given in life. You may not believe everything that you read in Program to Kill, and I'm not sure that I do either. But at a certain level, it doesn't really make a difference. After you read it, you're not going to be able to look at the world in the same way. And that may not sit very well with you. I know that it doesn't with me. Okay, so what am I even talking about? What is this book? It's certainly a conspiracy theory book. It could be categorized as true crime because of its subject matter, but it sort of puts all other true crime books to shame. There's something craven and voyeuristic in base about the true crime genre, which is very popular right now in podcast form particularly, but it's always been a staple of bookshops in America. There's a perpetual appetite for that kind of thing, and that's really part of the problem, but we'll get to that later. One of the things that I appreciate about Program to Kill is that McGowan has almost no style whatsoever as a writer. Now, that may be due to his limitations, or it may be an intentional choice, but either way it works. Because you don't want any of this material aestheticized. If you're not the kind of person who reads conspiracy theories, if that word has a negative connotation for you, I wouldn't recommend this to you either. You're going to need to get a few other conspiracy theories under your belt, at least to the point where you think that they're somewhat plausible, before you can begin to take in Program to Kill. Probably the one I would recommend is the book Ultimate Evil by Maury Terry. Now, I'm actually only halfway through this book myself currently, but Program to Kill obviously expands upon the main thesis in Terry's controversial book, to say the least, about the Son of Sam killings,
which is that rather than those murders being the product of one lone nut, David Berkowitz, they're in fact carried out by a group of people connected to a satanic cult. And there's a sense also in which McGowan's book puts to shame most other conspiracy books as well. And I'm thinking of works like James Shelby Downard and Michael Hoffman's work on the extreme end, which are kind of like schizoid prose poems. And I'm not saying McGowan never dips his toe into the synchromystical, but for the most part, this book is a fairly sober, fact-based litany of horrible deeds done by extreme psychopaths. Now, you know about these kind of things if you watch shows like Mindhunter or Hannibal or any number of the endlessly growing serial killer and related depravity-based entertainment in our time. But there's something about McGowan's work that just hits you in the gut. But none of those entertainments, or very few, pursue the idea that those evil minds, those deviant predators, might in fact be controlled and directed by the powers that be. Now, PTK has become something like required reading or even a foundational text for the online conspiracy left. Not just them, but especially them. For what I suppose are obvious reasons, the connection between serial killers and Uncle Sam. But this is really controversial for the left generally, which, influenced by the thinking of Marx, tends to prefer to look at systems as driving forces in the world and not individual actors or small groups of people carrying out plans in secret. A gestalt that is much more commonly associated with the right. Now, I view this as a total false dichotomy for reasons I don't really feel like unpacking at the moment. Another relevant paradigm that I totally reject on its face is that you should never attribute to malice what could be attributed to incompetence. Pretty much anything could be attributed to incompetence. But again, I think this is a false dichotomy. But let's get into the nitty-gritty of the book. And I'm going to go right to the thesis, such as it is. And I'm going to read a couple of quotes from Program to Kill.
For the rest of this episode, please visit patreon.com/symbolpod. You can get benefits like early access to episodes, exclusive bonus episodes, reading lists for the show, and other bonus content for as little as $3 a month. The Forest of Symbols will continue to explore the deepest symbolic roots of art, literature, philosophy, religion, science, and history, as well as interviews with some of the most interesting artists and thinkers of our time. But we need help from you to make this show the best it can be. Go to patreon.com/symbolpod and support the show today.